This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, I'm Alan Saunders, and this is the Philosopher's Zone. And this week we turn to a new area, neuroethics. Neuroethics concerns the ethics of the science of the mind and the ethical questions that arise out of our growing knowledge of the way in which the mind works. But it's a very new term. Before the year 2002, when it seems to have been coined, there was little need for it. But rapid advances in the science of the mind and the rise of pressing ethical issues surrounding them mean that we cannot any longer remain without the term. And to talk about the term and the field, I'm joined now in our Melbourne studio by Dr. Neil Levy from the Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics, and he's also at the James Martin 21st Century School at the University of Oxford. Neil, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Alan.
Well, a very basic question to begin with. What is neuroethics?
I guess the easiest way to think of neuroethics is on the model of bioethics. Bioethics is the discipline that's concerned with a set of ethical questions and philosophical questions that arise from new medical sciences or from the application of the medical sciences. Neuroethics is the discipline concerned with the ethical and philosophical questions that arise out of the sciences of the mind.
But there's a sort of dual thrust here, isn't there? It's about ethical problems arising out of the sciences of the mind, but also about ethical problems arising in the practice of the sciences of the mind.
In fact, there's a triple thrust. There's the two you've just identified, the practice of the sciences of the mind, the applications of the sciences of the mind, because more and more neuroscience in particular is giving us technical applications which we are using, and we're using them on a very large scale. Just think of the use of antidepressants in the Western world. But the third thrust is the more philosophical, which is what are the implications for old standard philosophical questions of the sciences of the mind? How should we rethink what it is to be human, the nature of consciousness, free will, self-control, the unity of the self? All of these are being illuminated by scientific breakthroughs.
Well, one of the ways in which we can address some of the issues that you mention is by looking at marginal cases, cases that, as it were, help to define the limits of what we can understand and what we can address ethically. And one such instance that you've given in something you've written is body integrity identity disorder, which is a very, very strange, I presume it's not a new psychiatric condition, but it's certainly a new diagnosis. So what's going on there, and why is it important for neuroethics?
Whether it's new is controversial. The first mention in the literature is in the 18th century, but basically there's nothing until very recently. People who are diagnosed with this identity disorder claim that a part of them, usually a limb, doesn't belong to them in some way. Now, they're not delusional. There are delusions. Somatoparaphrenia is the delusion in which people think that a limb isn't theirs. So somatoparaphrenia you get following a stroke, although there are less dramatic ways to get it as well, but generally following a stroke. And the patient says, hey, what's this? What's this in my bed? Can you take it away, nurse? And the nurse says, well, that's your arm. Now, that's a very florid delusion. BIID sufferers are not delusional. They know it's their arm. They use it in the course of everyday life. They say it feels normal in the sense that they can't point to anything about it that's different, but it doesn't fit with their image of who they are. The closest parallel, which would be familiar to most people, is what's now known as gender identity disorder, in which people say, my body isn't the right gender for me. So, you know, it's a perfectly fine body. You know, perhaps I'm a male to female transsexual, for instance, in which case I might say, well, I have a penis. It's a perfectly fine penis. It just doesn't fit with my self-image. So in the same way, these people are saying this limb doesn't fit with my self-image.
Why is this a problem for neuroethics? I can imagine somebody with body integrity identity disorder going to a surgeon and saying, look, this limb doesn't fit with my self-image, I want you to take it off, I want you to take it away. Whether the surgeon complies with that request, that's a question of medical ethics, but what makes this specifically a question in neuroethics?
Here's a parallel. There's a well-known phenomenon called the phantom limb. And the phantom limb occurs usually when people lose a limb, but then they go on feeling as though the limb is there. Again, they're not delusional. They know the limb's gone, but it feels as though it's there. And this can be a huge problem because sometimes the limb is in great pain, but there's nothing you can do to stop the pain because it's not actually there. Now, this has been illuminated to some extent by neuroscience. We've discovered that there are cortical maps of the body in the brain. There are multiple cortical maps. And part of the reason why people get this sensation is the cortical map is active, representing the limb in the brain, even though the limb doesn't in fact exist. So you can treat phantom limb by targeting the cortical map. Now, we don't know a lot about body integrity identity disorder as yet, but at least one possibility is that there is a dysfunction with sufferers' cortical maps. It's being represented in their cortical map. We know that because they can use it. But there are multiple cortical maps, and it may be that some of these are askew.
Well, that raises an interesting question, because if you didn't know this and somebody with this disorder came to a surgeon and said, this limb doesn't belong here, I want it removed, then there would be a simple question of medical ethics. And one can imagine the surgeon saying, well, look, my job is to care for people. My job is not to remove perfectly functioning parts of their bodies. Whereas the way that you put it now, it suggests that the surgeon could say, well, actually, there's something wrong with you. You are suffering from some disorder of the brain, and therefore it's not my job to do what you're asking me to do. But you actually have a neural problem going on here.
Well, there's two questions. One is, what's the nature of the problem? And the second question is, how is it best dealt with? So it might be that the phenomenon is caused by environmental changes, for instance, in the way that, you know, psychoanalytic syndromes are caused. So there's no neural problem. There's nothing wrong with the brain, but there's something wrong with the subject's relationship to the world. That's independent of whether it's best treated by targeting the brain. Because all thoughts, all experiences have a neural basis. One question is, what's the nature of the dysfunction? Is it caused by something internal or something external? And the second question is, how is it best treated? Now, it may be that even though this is a neural problem, on the assumption that it is, it's still best treated by amputation. It may be that nothing else works.
We're talking about neural problems here, and therefore we're more or less presupposing that there is an identity between the mind and the brain. In other words, we are dismissing the possibility of dualism, the idea that the mind and the brain are in fact two different things, that perhaps the brain is the physical organ that supports the mind, but that the mind is something else. Does dualism enter into questions of neuroethics?
Well, metaphysical dualism, the idea that the mind is quite independent of the brain, I think looks just dramatically or radically implausible in the light of what we know about how states of consciousness can be altered by targeting the brain directly. So we can do all kinds of things which influence people's experience in very subtle ways or very dramatic ways by transcranial magnetic stimulation, by the use of drugs, by literally freezing one hemisphere or the other, or by various other kinds of ways of focusing pulses on the brain. So we've learnt that the brain consists of, or perhaps it's better to say that the mind consists of, because we're talking at the functional level here, of myriad more or less independent mechanisms doing their own thing without supervision from consciousness and in ways that can dissociate and cause all kinds of strange phenomena. So, for instance, we now know that there's more than one visual system. There's a visual system that subserves conscious experience, and there's a visual system that actually subserves movement and the guidance of reaching behavior. And these things can, as the neuroscientists say, dissociate. They can come apart. So we can get syndromes in which people claim to be blind, and they are functionally blind. They walk into walls if they're not guided. They have no visual stimuli in consciousness. To all intents and purposes, they are entirely blind, and yet they're able to use visual information because the lesion has only affected one of their visual pathways, the conscious one. So people with this experience, it's called blindsight, can guess. And that's what their experience is. They experience it as guessing. They can guess where things are at much higher levels than chance, and much better than people who actually have a problem with both visual pathways. And I think that kind of dissociation is very counterintuitive. It clashes with common sense, and it fragments consciousness in a way that Descartes couldn't conceive of.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Dr. Neil Levy from the Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics in Melbourne about the new discipline of neuroethics. Neil, one of the key questions, if we're thinking about any ethical issue, is who the ethical agent here is. To put it simply, who am I going to blame and who am I going to praise? What does the new science of neurology tell us about this? How do I identify the self?
That is one of the central questions in neuroethics, to my mind, and there is no uncontroversial answer. Well, we have all these independent mechanisms to which I just referred, and some people want to say, well, it turns out there isn't a self. In fact, that there's these semi-independent mechanisms, all of them doing their own thing, and the self is an illusion. I don't think that's the right view to take. I think the right view is that the self is an achievement. It's what happens when we get a unification of these mechanisms, when they start sharing goals and they start engaging in goal-directed behavior and being able to make plans, so they are unified across time. And it's never a perfect unity because they will, under certain conditions, tend in their own directions, and that might be a direction that the agent as a whole doesn't want to go in. But nevertheless, it's a unity that we do achieve. And I think we see this in ordinary child development when infants learn gradually to control their own behavior and to be able to defer gratification, to be able to plan for the future. And the phenomenon of the independent mechanisms doing their own thing is in fact something we observe all the time. It's not how we think of it, although sometimes we might think of it a bit like that. I'm just thinking of ordinary cases of weakness of the will in which you think, well, I know I shouldn't eat the slice of cake, but I'm strongly tempted to, and we feel as though we're having an internal struggle. That might be quite a veridical perception. We really are having an internal struggle. We really are pitting parts of ourselves against ourselves. But for the most part, we are single beings able to make our own way in the world, and our perception of ourselves and each other as unified agents is, I think, for the most part, true.
What role does memory play in this? We know that in the 17th century, the English philosopher John Locke argued that it was memory that more or less guaranteed my identity over time as a continuing agent in the world. Do you think memory is important?
I do think memory is very important. It's playing a very important role in unifying the self. I think the ability to get all the parts of the self to pull together and make a single agent requires unity over time, and unity over time requires memory, so that the self in the future recalls what kind of goal I was pursuing and is able to continue to pull towards that goal. I think future-directed desires might be more important and more neglected. There's a wonderful set of studies showing how children gradually learn self-control. They're the marshmallow studies, they're so called, after the reward that were given to children. So children are asked just to delay gratification in these studies. They were told, you can have one marshmallow now or two marshmallows if you wait. You can have one marshmallow whenever you like. If you wait long enough, I'll give you two. Very young children can't wait. Within a few seconds, they're eating the first marshmallow. The older the child gets, the longer it can wait. And the length of waiting, the ability to defer gratification, is a very good predictor of a whole range of other achievements later in life. So, for instance, it's a very good predictor, much better than IQ, I believe, predictor of academic success. The child is learning how to delay its gratification, to make itself a single being able to pursue goals which are maximally beneficial to itself, or which it perceives as maximally beneficial to itself. And it does that by learning a set of techniques which distract the self, distract the parts that want immediate gratification, which squelch them, which weaken their power. And I think these are the kinds of mechanisms that unify the self.
What about when something happens to memory? I want to suggest two possibilities here. One is quite common, the other is a bit science fictional. But to take the common one, in some critical remarks about Locke's idea of the importance of memory, the Scottish philosopher Thomas Reid said, well, imagine you have a young boy who's punished for stealing apples, and he grows up and becomes a military officer who captures the enemy's standard, and then the military officer becomes an old general. Now, the military officer remembered being the boy who was punished for stealing the apples. The old general remembers being the military officer who captured the standard, but the old general doesn't remember, because it was a long time ago, being the young boy. And so if you're saying that this is the same person persisting over time, what you are in effect saying is that A equals B and B equals C, but A doesn't equal C, which is contrary to the way in which identity, the very logical concept of identity, normally works. So how can we uphold the notion of memory as important to identity in the face of that sort of argument?
It might be interesting to turn around Reid's objection and to imagine, or not to, we don't have to imagine, we can look at real neurological symptoms which lead to loss of memory. So, for example, anterior grade amnesia, in which the agent loses all recall of their prior experiences. So they lose their subjective memory, they lose their memory of their own experiences, perhaps it'd be better to say experiential memory. What they don't lose is a lot of the other things that underlie identity. They don't lose their semantic memory, they don't lose their memory for facts, they don't lose their memory of the language they speak, they don't lose their common general knowledge. And those kinds of things partly underlie who we are, because they underlie our cognitive style, they underlie our cultural identity. In that case, I think we still want to say it's the same person. And I think one of the things we're learning from the sciences of the mind is that these questions don't have neat answers. We're going to say A is the same person as B, just in case enough of the right kinds of connections hold between them.
What about the second possibility I was going to mention, the more science fictional one, is the sort of thing that we have in movies like Total Recall, where people's memories are radically altered, or they have memories, in inverted commas, inserted into their minds. Now, I don't know whether this is ever going to be a technical possibility, but what are the implications, the ethical implications of that?
Let me deal with the technical possibility question first. I suspect the direct wiring idea is certainly not on the horizon, and it may well, in fact, be impossible for reasons to do with the holism of the mental. That is, that the mental fits together in irrational agents as a whole, and all the connections are very important. And if you start severing them, you might lose the agent altogether. You may not have a rational being anymore. But we know from much lower tech sciences of the mind, in particular psychology, that it's quite possible to insert more banal memories into people's minds. So the work of Elizabeth Loftus is very important here. Loftus tells subjects, she speaks to their family and gets a collection of memories from them, and then she tells the subject that she's got these memories, but among them is one false one. And in fact, it's one that she's made up. The classic one is getting lost in a shopping mall when they were three and then being rescued by an elderly person. And she asks the subject to pick the false one. And they often pick the wrong one. They pick a true memory as a false one. And when they're asked about the, in fact, false memory of getting lost in a shopping mall, they say they remember it well. And she's even been able to find that about 20% of people will remember really bizarre happenings like being abducted. Now, all of this is important for neuroethics, of course, because we are having people convicted on recovered memory evidence. And Loftus' work shows that recovered memory is not at all reliable. How does this affect identity? As I said, I think identity is not an all or nothing affair. The more important the inserted memory is, the more central to the person's goals and plans, the kind of things that make them the person they are. And I'm thinking of quite common sense things here, like my identity might be tied up with my family, with my culture, with my religion, with my job. The more central to that kind of concern the false memory is, the more we want to say that the person is constructing a partly false sense of identity. But again, I don't think identity is an all or nothing notion.
And how in the future do you see the new discipline of neuroethics going? What are the new frontiers in terms of issues you're going to have to address?
I think the hard problem is what is in fact called the hard problem, very famously by an Australian philosopher, David Chalmers, which is the nature of consciousness. I think that this is going to be the central neuroethical issue. You might have seen recently reports of brain imaging studies on a patient in a persistent vegetative state. This was a patient who had shown no responsiveness for 12 months after a car accident, other than preserved sleeping-waking cycles, but no responsiveness to her environment. In this study, they put her in an fMRI machine, a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, and studied her brain while they gave her various stimuli. They gave her sentences, and when she heard sentences, the language part of her brain was active. They asked her to imagine playing tennis, and when given that instruction, the supplementary motor area of her brain was active, which is the same area you see if you were asked to imagine playing tennis. And they asked her to navigate a familiar environment, and parts of the brain associated with navigation, like the parahippocampal cortex, lit up in her. And the neuroscientist studying her concluded that she was conscious. I think that's too quick, because we don't know what the neural correlates of consciousness are, and we also do know that unconscious subjects, for example, subjects in a state of epileptic fugue or suffering automatism or just sleepwalking, can do complex things. What we're going to have to find out is what's the nature of consciousness, what are the neural mechanisms that underlie it, and what are the relations between these two, such that we can answer this question with a greater degree of certainty than we can right now.
Dr. Neil Levy from the Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Alan.
The Philosopher's Zone is produced by Polly Rickard, with technical production this week from Manny Wasserstrom. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with more ethics.
ABC Radio National. more than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.